This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I am Coach Jen in Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Mary Kitzmiller from Kemp, Texas, and you are listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for February 13th, episode 2370. Today's show is brought to you by Horseware. Good morning, Horse World.
What is your favorite day of the week?
You never stop learning. You never stop understanding. It's more in depth than just riding a horse. Knowing that for the rest of my life I could work on this and I'll never stop learning.
I love that part of the intro. Welcome back, Mary Kitzmiller. You're here the second Thursday of every month where we get to sit around and geek out on horse training of all sorts. How you doing, girl?
I'm doing pretty good. We're under 8 feet of water. Or maybe it's 2 inches. I can't tell anymore.
Now, you oft times lament standing water this time of year at your place in Kemp, Texas. Is it really, really flat there so the water has nowhere to go? Is that kind of how it works?
Well, I live in a part of Texas that people don't really know about. And it's like a swamp. I really live in Louisiana, but it says it's Texas on the map. But
I understand.
So, yeah, when most people who've never been to Texas, especially think of Texas, they think of like what they see in movies, which is often, it says it's Texas, but it's not. It's Monument Valley, which is, you know, a whole different state. I think Utah or Arizona, one of those. So they think like rocks and desert and dry. And yes, there's a lot of Texas that is that. But there is also like the east part of Texas or even down around near Houston, which is green and wet. And it's like 1,000,000,000% humidity all the time. So you take a shower in the morning, step outside, and then you need a shower again. It's that kind of stuff. And that's where I live.
That's where you live.
Yeah. And I'm in really low-lying ground. So it'll rain and rain and rain and rain and everything floods. We don't get like a real flood where we have to evacuate or anything like that, but just standing water.
Just enough to create misery and mosquitoes.
Yeah. But then in the summer, crippling drought. So that's what I'm dealing with.
So during the rainy months in Kemp, Texas, where it is relatively warm and wet like that, are there any special precautions or routines you take with the horses to ward off all of the nasty things that come with wet weather?
I try. Most of my horses are in a turnout situation where they have access to shelters. I open up my arena when it's raining. I think the biggest thing in any kind of element you're dealing with is you don't necessarily have to have your horse wrapped up in a bunch of blankets and in a stall, but they do need access to wind block and overhead shelter where they can get out of, they've got a dry spot where they're not going to get rained on. But other than that, I just make sure, especially with the horses I'm working, to check their feet. And it's often a situation of I can't prevent thrush, but I can treat it. So sometimes with thrush, we think, oh, it just makes their feet a little white and chalky. But it can wreak a lot of havoc and cause a lot of pain. So, with a horse like my horse Guthrie, who deals with navicular, so that is often a source of lameness for him. It can be compounded by the fact that he also might be dealing with thrush, which can cause a lot of pain if it just starts eating away at that foot. So, a lot of thrush remedies on him.
So just keep an eye on everything and don't let it get out of control, huh?
Yeah. Keep them groomed. Watch for things like rain rot, and which I don't really deal with all that often, surprisingly.
Interesting. It is funny that way, rain rot. I had one horse in my lifetime that just seemed to have rain rot all the time. She rarely ever got rain rot in large patches, although that did happen at least once a year. But she invariably had a couple of dots here and there on her body. And between me and my vet, we were like, what's going on here? But it was just a constant battle. And I've had lots of other horses that you'd have 10 horses at the barn that were coming down with some kind of rain scald because of weather issues. But then you'd have 10 other horses in the barn living in the exact same circumstances. Had no effect. It's such a random thing.
Yeah, I think immune systems come into play. In Guthrie's case, he's allergic to all the things. And he even reacts to the things they put on him.
Cut there. Hang on 1 second. I'll be right back.
Okay. So I assume I am still live. Anyway, that's something I deal with all the time with that horse.
Sorry about that. I'm back.
Not a problem. I just started talking.
Yeah. Live listeners, you get to hear that. That will get edited out for the final product that goes out. Nigel had an altercation with some wire fencing. So he is always just coming off stall rest. And I looked out the window because I have him in a paddock outside the window so I can keep an eye on him. He was galloping madly about, which is something he does not need to be doing right now.
Oh, no. Yeah, no way.
Yeah, so Glenn's going to go bring him back in and put him back in the barn. Yeah, anyhow, deep cleansing breath. I had my heart going there for a while. You know, don't need to compound the injuries. Anyhow, so interesting how their overall health, the state of their immune system, what particular little micro environment lives inside their hair coat all come into play. That's so interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Interesting, sometimes frustrating, but
there's a very, very, very fine line between interesting and infuriating or frustrating. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
I use it as a jump rope now.
There we go. Well, every month we always start the show out after, of course, we catch up on what we've been doing since we spoke last on the third Thursday of the month. We have a training tip, and invariably that training tip is inspired by something. So what is our training tip and what inspired it this time?
So the training tip is called Don't Be Afraid to Experiment. So experimenting with your horse training. And this is something that I notice with amateur horse students, horse trainers, you've probably got a 9-to-5 job and horse training is your passion and hobby. So it's not your profession. And so many people are doing this, I say more recreationally, but, you know, they're very serious about working with their horses. But in between taking a lesson with someone or going to a clinic or watching a DVD, I see many people just get really lost in, I don't know what to do. I don't, this is all I was told to do at the last lesson. It's 2 weeks until my next lesson. And they kind of fall into this, not sure what to do with their horse. And I would say to those people is exactly what the training tip is don't be afraid to experiment with your horse training and don't be afraid to try new things. Just because, you haven't been told to do it yet, doesn't mean you can't just branch out just a little bit within reason, and see what works for you and your horse. So most people have a really good sense of what might be potentially harmful in working with your horse. You know, my caveat is stay safe and within reason, branch out when you're working with your horse and let the horse tell you what is working and what isn't working. So, you know, the thing I've always been told when training horses is if you try something new, you're not really going to know if it works until the next day. So I might have a ride that I thought went amazing and everything went well, but then the next day my horse comes out and he's worse than he was. So that tells me, okay, I need to change things up a little bit. But sometimes, I'll be riding around and I'll try something. And when I come out the next day, my horse comes back and he's better. So that usually tells me that, okay, I'm on the right track. I should keep going. So this works for, you know, any training method you're using. If your horse gets consistently better or consistently worse after you've worked with them, that means, you know, that's going to be your gauge for where you need to go. I hope that makes some sort of
sense. Yes, it does. Yes, it does make sense. Absolutely. So I have a question.
Yes.
So you take your horse out and you're going to work on half passes or leg yields, moving your horse away from the left leg and go swimmingly. It's like, wow, I got a lot done today. Woo! When you take the horse out next, whether that's the next day or 3 days later, is because I've had this exact thing happen with my horse. I'm not working on that exercise specifically. I'm working on something vaguely related. For example, bending properly through a turn. And my horse is like, wow, he's getting this better than he usually does. I like this. I can attribute that in part to the fact that the previous exercise I did the day before sunk in really, really well. It made sense to the horse. And that has had a trickle-down effect onto other skill sets. Is that logical?
I think so. You know, there's a few exceptions. Say, you know, you did your half passes and then in the interim, he got cast in a stall and he's a little sore today, so he's not doing as well with the lateral today. So, you know, sometimes something can happen in between that has nothing to do with the training you're doing. It changes the outcome. But yeah, for the most part, another one of my favorite sayings, and it's kind of abstract, is everything is everything else. So, you might be working on yielding the hindquarters, but working on that body part can actually improve your turnarounds. And what I mean by turnaround, that's like the reining spins that we do in the Western classes. So that's a shoulder control exercise. Working on getting your horse to move forward and freely on the loose rein can make him softer in the bridle. So two kind of seemingly unrelated things can actually complement and affect each other when you're training. And most of the time in horse training, when I'm working on a complex maneuver, so let's say the turnaround. So that's where the horse is, his hind end is relatively stationary and his shoulders are moving and he's spinning around. In the reining, we usually do four spins in any given turnaround maneuver. And so that's a pretty complex maneuver and it takes a lot of little pieces to make it work. So if my horse was doing turnarounds really great, and then all of a sudden it falls apart, which does happen, like they lose it for some reason, then what I need to do is to pull it all apart like a car. I'm going to, you know, lift up the hood, check the engine, start pulling things apart, fix each individual little element, and then put it all back together. So you know, I might need to loosen those hindquarters up. I might need to work on getting him to go forward. I might need to work on side passing or half passing a little bit so he understands to move away from my legs. There's you know, a million little cogs that go into it. And then I look at all of those things individually, see what isn't working, fix that thing, and then put it all back together and see what I have. So it's sort of like being a mechanic.
A little bit. Oh, yeah, there's a lot bit. Of that.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of that.
Are you hearing me twice, Mary?
No, I heard one echo earlier.
Okay, my computer's acting a little bit odd today, but we'll just set that aside. So let's take that a step further. We're going to use the experimentation part. I have a horse that I ride, and that horse struggles with moving forward off my aids. So we're going to break this way down. Moving forward in a straight line off my aids. For example, we are walking and I ask for trot or jog. He trots or jogs, but he does it in kind of like, okay, versus a yes, sir. What are some things that I should break that down and experiment with to improve that one particular thing? Because there's a lot going on, even though it sounds simple, go from walk to trot in a straight line, but there are a lot of ingredients there.
Yes, yes. And actually walking forward in a straight line can be kind of a complex maneuver. And when I usually deal with horses like this in lessons, and the person's like, oh, I have a hard time getting him to go forward, have a hard time picking up the trot, you know, yada, yada, yada. When I have them, when I tell them, okay, well, go ahead and try it and let's see, I usually see a person who's trying to do the finished product, which is they have their horse all collected. They're trying to keep him perfectly on a straight line. And they're just having heck with it because the horse is just not moving out freely. So even though walking forward on the bridle straight seems relatively simple, in order to figure out where it's breaking down, we need to make it way simpler. So what I tend to do is make them loosen their rein, which is very hard sometimes with English riders, getting y'all to let go of your rein a little bit. Like a good. And my favorite thing about that is if you're afraid of losing control by doing that, don't worry, you never have it. So just try. Sometimes I'll go all the way down to the buckle if I don't think I'm going to get bucked off within a stride or two. So loose rein, I don't care where your headset is. I don't care if you're on the bit. I don't care if your back is lifted, yada, yada, yada. All I want you to do is go. And in some cases, I won't even worry about where you go. Just go anywhere. I'm in an arena. And if I'm not, don't worry. There's an ocean on either side. Something will get me stopped eventually. So I don't care where you go. Just go. And this is often the case with your young and green horses of don't try to follow that horse up and get everything happening at once. Just work on the gas pedal. Just go somewhere. And I'll work on that in my transitions on a loose rein. I'll be very liberal about where they go. If they want to go to the left, great. If they want to go to the right, great. If they get stuck in a corner, I'll steer them out and then give them a loose rein again. And I work on just go and trying to get it all to flow. If they're too fast, if they go from walking really slow and pokey, and then they bolt forward, which is actually a common thing that can happen. The horse goes from really behind the bridle and really tense and sticky to pedal to the floor. Then I'll gather up my reins, slow them down, calm them down, and then try it again and find that happy in between of forward without bolting or being super reactive. So once I get forward, where I can, and a lot of times giving the horse the reins, they kind of go, oh, maybe they were a little bit afraid of the bridle and they were hiding behind the bridle and that's why they couldn't go forward. Or in the case of just a really lazy horse, going forward on the bit with engagement in the hind end, that's a lot of work. That's kind of like doing sit-ups, they got to use a lot of muscles and re-engage. So sometimes you need to just, hey, do it without being on the bridle. Or on the bit, do it without the collection, do it without the headset, and see if that works for you. And they kind of go, okay, this is much easier.
Yeah. And then give them some success history.
Yeah.
So that they're willing to try a little harder. That makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Well, and that's another thing is I'll have someone say, oh, my horse, it takes him forever to pick up the canter and he won't stay cantering. And they think the problem is in the canter. But when they start warming the horse up and I see them walking, I see the walk is pretty pathetic as well. Energy, cantering is a whole other ballgame. And horses like that, they don't seem to have a lot of work ethic. I kind of want to call them lazy, but they want to save energy. With a horse like that.
To their defense, that type of personality and that type of physical energy is very, very user friendly in that someone who doesn't ride a lot, doesn't feel particularly secure on a horse, lacks confidence, etc., that horse is also very likely to forgive mistakes so that the rider is going to feel comfortable. So you have to take that kind of a horse and say, we can get a little sharper without becoming a nut job, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and it's a natural thing for a horse to save energy. Because even though they can run a million miles an hour, they can only do that for so long. And that's how their predators will take over they may be faster than most of the predators coming after them, but there are predators out there that can run them down to where they have no more energy left. So a horse has to save energy. He needs that.
Yeah.
So it's a very natural thing for them to want to do that. But how you get through to a horse like that, that's constantly wanting to conserve energy and giving you the very bare minimum he possibly can, is if you have a problem getting him to canter, then when you finally get that to happen, don't make him canter for 20 minutes. Because for the horse, he finally gives you what in his mind is a Herculean effort, like, fine, I'll canter. And you keep kicking him. He's like, well, that was worth it. You know, why don't I just go back to walking again? Because I did the thing for you. I did something that took a lot of effort on my part. And what do I get? You keep kicking me. So that's where they start getting really dull to your leg. And you got to get the spurs out. And then you got to get the sharper spurs out. And then you got to tap them with the whip. So for a horse that you have trouble getting him to canter, as soon as he gives you that effort, I like throw the reins away. I stop, like where we are, wherever we are. I let him stop and breathe. I hug on him and I leave him alone for a few minutes and I let him know, you give me a little try. This is the amount I'm asking for. Just this little thimbleful of try. I'm going to give you the world.
Yeah.
Now, eventually you would want to canter that horse, you know, a circle or two, but you have to build to that slowly. So
you don't start with canter two strides and take a break. You start with canter two strides, take a break, canter six strides, take a break, canter 10 strides, take a break. And that could take weeks and weeks and weeks to get to that level, depending on the horse and rider and the situation. And I just want to say, I have used this technique with Nigel, my OTTB. He's not even an OTTB. He is the never made it to the track thoroughbred. When I got him, he couldn't get his right lead. And as soon as you'd ask for right lead, he has what you have very appropriately termed poisoned aids. He knew what the aids were, and it was so traumatic for him mentally that it was a complete and utter meltdown. So we worked through things, and we got to the point where we could get a right lead canter. But very limited success, because I was using the method that you used before. When we did finally get right lead canter, it's like, okay, now we're going to practice right lead canter, which was a serious struggle for him. So I got wiser, because I get to talk to lots of wise trainers like you. When he did get the right lead canter, we would literally canter three strides and I'd ask him to come back to a halt. I forget what you call it, but not halt in the reining or dressage way. It's just, let's just simply come back to a stop, as in I released the aids that told him to continue cantering, and he was perfectly happy to come back to a stop. And that's what I did. I scratched his shoulders. I told him he was the most wonderful pony in the world. Sometimes we'd get mints, and we would sit there for what I thought was an eternity, when in fact was probably 5 minutes. And it was amazing how quickly that changed his attitude towards the aid. When I would say right lead canter, he'd go, oh, sure, I can try that, versus tail swatting, tooth grinding. Gah! He would say, sure, I can do that. And we would canter 2-3 strides. We'd love all over him. And mind you, I would only practice this every occasionally. But after a few months, I could do it several times in the same session when I first started. I could do that once before the angry face came out. After a few months, I could do it 3, 4, 5, 6 different times of canter right. Sure, I can try that. Ooh, I get a break afterwards. And after we got to that point, then I started to add strides. Because when I tried it the other way, the angry teeth came back out. He needed more time to soak that up and feel successful and anticipate what he perceives as the reward. Stop, take a break, get a scratch in the shoulders, maybe have a mint, hang out in the shade, all of those things. And so experimentation, something else that I've learned from you. I tried method A. It's like, limited success. That doesn't mean throw away the method. That meant let's alter the ingredients just a tiny bit. And that works for me and my horse.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, if you're doing something over and over and over and you're getting the same result, then obviously what you're doing is not working. And I think a lot of people are just really afraid to venture off the path and think, well, what if I try it this way? You know, if you try a new way and it doesn't work, okay, well, let's do something else. And, you know, think like a scientist, view your data, view what's happening as a result of the things you're doing. And whenever that trend starts to go to the positive, like I did this 6 months in a row and I got pretty good results. Okay. So you file that away in your little mental notebook. Okay, I should try that more often. Most of us, for fear of doing something wrong, we're waiting on someone to tell us to do something, or, you know, we're too afraid to think outside the box and make a mistake. Horses are forgiving. You know where the line is of doing something that's unfair to your horse or potentially harmful. It's okay to experiment and not have something work and then say, okay, well, back to the drawing board. And that's where you're going to start learning and you're going to build more confidence in what you're doing with your horse.
Yeah, I like that.
Think like a scientist.
Yes.
I like that because you tried something. And I'm still hearing myself back. So I don't know if that's coming through on the recording or not, but there we go. You think like a scientist. Learn, you tried something different. You experimented a little bit. Went, no, that's really not quite getting the result I was hoping for. But to quote one of my heroes, Jamie Savage, from Mythbusters, it's all data. Pick out the bits and pieces of that experiment and file them away. This might go in the negative column and this might go in the positive column. Or sometimes it goes in the column of, I'm not sure if it was positive or negative, but it's still data. And if you really take the time to absorb all that, even something that you experimented with that you thought was, quote, a failure, that's giving you important data that might be very, very useful later on. So really keep track of all that stuff. That's fascinating, great, fascinating stuff. And speaking of science-y, thinking like a scientist, the folks who developed this product called Ice Vibe, which is distributed by Horseware, our title sponsor, were really science-y, and they figured out a great way to help your horse have a long and happy competitive or pleasure career. So we're going to hear from them. And when we come back, we're going to give our auditor Avery a call. And Mary's going to answer her training question.
In the world of horse racing and elite equestrian sports, it's all about how to prepare and repair. IceVibe is a truly portable and highly efficient circulation therapy system for your horse. Before activity, prepare to prevent damage by using the IceVibe's vibration pads. Repair after the event by using the unique combination of cold packs and vibration to minimize swelling and encourage blood flow. And because it's battery powered, IceVibe is truly portable. The essential and affordable tool to prepare and repair. IceVibe.
You can find out more details about Ice Vibe at ice-vibe.com or horseware.com, or ask your local tack shop or online supplier for more information about Ice Vibe circulation therapy from Horseware.
And we've got our guest, Avery Morgan, who happens to be an HRN auditor on the line. If you're not an auditor, you need to go to horsesinthemorning.com. And look for the auditor banner on that page and click on it, and it will explain to you just how to become an auditor and all of the awesome perks that come with it. Welcome to the show, Avery.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
All right. So we talked about auditor questions, which we've got a lot of great questions this month. And you have one about a spooky horse. Okay, so what are you dealing with your horse and spookiness?
Sure. So I have two horses, and one horse is, I mean, either horse is super spooky. They're both, well-trained, well-traveled, they compete a lot. But I noticed the other day, my neighbors decided it was a good day to cut down trees as I was riding out in my outdoor. And every time a tree would crash, eventually they kind of got used to it, but my one horse, who he's a thoroughbred and he's really calm, he just kind of would jump in place and just stop, which that's kind of my preferred method of spooking. And my other horse would kind of squirt forward a few steps, and then when she wasn't bolting, she was easy to get under control. But that got me thinking, like, is there a way to teach a horse to spook more like Freddy, who spooks in place, versus Sassy, who tends to jump forward and want to run off a few steps before coming back?
That is a really, really good question. I think spooking in places is everyone's preferred method of spooking. It's pretty, if we had to have a spook, so it's pretty rideable. So this is something, we just had a tree cut down at my place this last year, and I can say firsthand, it is very scary for the horse.
Yeah.
And even your broke horses, you can have a horse that's been exposed to so many things and steady eddy, and there will never be nothing for the horse to spook at. There, something big can happen, and even your brokest horse can be a little spooky. When that happens, because it is not an if, it is a when, unfortunately, it's probably going to happen. How can we get the horse to spook manageably? So the thing that I really use for that is when I'm doing any kind of ground training or riding a horse as they're progressing through the levels and they're getting less green and they're getting more educated, my deal is, I kind of make a deal with the horse of, listen, I know there are going to be times that it's going to be too scary and you're going to have to move your feet, because that, for them, that is their safety. If anything happens, they're better off spooking first, running first, and asking questions later. That's how they survive. And there will be times when the horse just, they say, I have to move my feet. I'm a prey animal. This is how I survive. I need to move my feet. So when I'm training the horse, I do a bunch of exercise where, and again, the deal I strike is I try to show them, best case scenario is to not react and just stay with me, listen to me for further instructions. But if you have to move your feet, let's do it in a way where we both make this out alive. And so I do a lot of hindquarter yields and one rein stops with that horse. So a one rein stop is an emergency stop. It's where you bend the horse around using one rein and get them to disengage their hindquarters. Many of us will practice this here and there, and or sometimes we just read about it and then we think it's going to come through for us in an emergency when our horse is bolting, bucking, all of those things. Mm-hmm. But so that is one reason that I teach my horse to do that, so that I can get them stopped if something happens. But the thing about one rein stops, and I say this, in the first 30 days of training especially, you cannot do too many. And here's the reason why you need to practice it about 10 million more times than you think you need to. Because, and I noticed this with human students, I will teach them a one rein stop. I'll explain it to them. They understand why it's so important. And we'll practice it a few times. But if they don't practice enough, what usually happens the first time their horse reacts is the person freezes. And I'm yelling, one rein stop, and they're not moving. And then they finally, their brain kicks into gear, and they're able to get their horse slowed down. And the reason why they weren't able to engage is they're just in a state of panic. They can't help themselves. This is something that I have problems with, too, when my horse reacts. So you practice the one rein stop for yourself so that it becomes muscle memory. You don't even think, you know, as soon as the horse moves, you go for that rein, bend the horse down. This works the same for the horse, because so in a situation where something unexpected happens, the tree branch falls to the ground and your horse moves, if you've practiced this 1 billion times, what you'll notice is your horse may start to go like, oh, I'm going to move forward now. But as you go into your muscle memory and you relax your seat and you slide your hand down the rein, what I've noticed, if you've practiced this enough, and there is no enough, you cannot do it enough, but if you practice this a really good amount, is at, before I even make contact with the horse's mouth, before I even get that rein fully drawn up, that horse goes, oh yeah, I know what we're doing. And they'll soften and stop their feet before I even get their head turned. So that is the way Yeah, that is the way where you can get your horse to start going to muscle memory of, oh, this is what we do if I spook. I listen, you know, I feel my rider go for the rein, and I know what the next thing is because we've practiced this so many times. And the best thing to do is to slow down, soften to the pressure that I'm feeling from my rider, wait for further instructions. So I hope that makes sense of, you know, we practice it so we can get our horse shut down when they're running off and things like that. But an even greater benefit is to try to build that muscle memory with your horse. And it will even go a step further as that horse gets more educated, is when you see that tree branch start to, you know, oh, you know, it's going to fall down. If you think about what you should do before you even start picking up that rein is relax, sit deep in that saddle. That horse will read that and they'll go, oh, I remember this. This is when my one rein stops. And you might even be lucky enough that they don't even start reacting because they feel you start sitting deep in that saddle, relaxing, take a deep breath, and they know what's coming next because you've practiced this hundreds of times of relax, deep in the saddle, go for that rein, tip that nose, yield those hindquarters, settle to a stop, take another deep breath. Does that make sense?
That makes so much sense. And I mean, I've done one rein stops on colts and I teach it to every horse when they're young, but then I think I kind of, you know, once I feel like I don't really need it for control, I move on. But it makes sense that it brings them down to relax and helps my muscle memory too beforehand, you know, even with the older experienced horse.
Exactly.
And just use it to relax them, not even for control.
Yeah, yeah, because, you know, when I first do the one rein stops, one thing that I always add to mine is to, you know, like I said before, sit deep in that saddle, kind of let all the air out of your body, and then start sliding your hand down. And that will actually be the precursor to what I do for advanced stops, where I sit deep, say, whoa, pull on the reins, yada, yada, yada. But that initial relax, deep in that saddle, act like sandbags are kind of pulling your legs down to the ground. That's the precursor to any kind of stopping or downward transition I'm going to do. And that can signal your horse, don't go, relax. The other thing you can do is if I'm on a horse, whether it's a green horse or a broke horse, and something really big is going on, and I know that even this really nice educated horse I'm on may spook. For instance, like if I'm at a show and someone's been dumped off their horse and this horse is running right at me, I don't have time to get off. And what do I do? This horse might even run smack into my horse. What I will actually do in that case, or like you're watching the tree getting cut and you know that branch is going to hit and it's probably going to spook your horse. What you can do even to kind of help control whatever reaction your horse is going to have is I'll gently flex their nose to one side. And this works only if you've really practiced a lot of lateral flexions and disengagement. Don't do it on a horse that's never had that done because then you'll really make them feel trapped. But I do this, like I said, if someone's been dumped off their horse at the show and this horse is screaming around the arena and they're coming at me, in order to keep my horse from picking up that energy and running off as well, I'll just stay deep in that saddle, flex their nose around, and just hold them there. And that way, when that horse goes by me and brushes up against my horse may go, ah, and move, but they're already in the bend. So they'll probably, in all likelihood, just spiral around in a few little circles. And I'll sit there gently holding their nose to one side and wait for them to go into that disengagement, soften, relax, give to the bridle. And that's something, if they could whirly bird around 100 times, I can ride that. That's something I can stay seated. It's better than a bolt, better than a buck, or spooking to the side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds like it would be really helpful to kind of, especially for things that you know are going to spook them, and you can kind of prepare.
Yeah, sometimes we're lucky enough to see it coming. So there are things you can do. If you have tons of time, you can get off and but there are some times where just even getting off is not going to be the best thing to do. So that's what I will do is if I see it coming from a distance, I'll take their nose to the side. And that helps, even if they do have a reaction, it helps curb it and make it a little bit more manageable. So So I hope that makes sense. And hopefully you won't have many trees being cut down in the future.
It definitely makes sense. And I think we're going to go out and practice lots of running tracks even on my ball courses.
Awesome. Good deal.
Thanks, well, good Avery. That was fun.
Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate this. It's wonderful.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's always so much fun getting listener questions because invariably I can take some little nugget from that question and apply it to something that's going on in my horsey life.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully that's my hope anyway.
There's always a nugget there. Yeah. And speaking of nuggets, one of our other longtime sponsors here on the Horses in the Morning show and Mary's show is the folks at Total Saddle Fit. And Total Saddle Fit, what the heck is that? Total Saddle Fit, it's a fellow by the name of Justin. And he takes his many, many, many years experience as a professional saddle guy. And he solves problems that everyday equestrians have with making their horses tack as comfortable and effective as possible. And one of the things he did was to create the Total Saddle Fit Shoulder Relief Cinch and Girth. He's got the English and Western versions. And it helps the saddle fit better because the girth goes in the right place or the cinch goes in the right place. We've all had those horses where the cinch is too far forward and everything slides forward and pokes them in the elbows. Have you experienced pokey elbows?
I'm sure I have at one point or another.
Everybody's got pokey elbows somewhere where you always feel like the horse's elbows are, there's a girth in the way. And that's not a good thing. So he invented this cinch and girth. And the awesome part about it is made with top quality materials. And when you go to totalsaddlefit.com, pick out the one that suits you and your English, Western, or Australian stock saddle that suits you best. You purchase it. They ship it to you. You can try it for 30 days. Make sure you really do love it as much as you think. And make sure your horse really does love it as much as you think he will for 30 days. And if you don't love it to death, you can send it back and you get a refund, including the shipping. He's that sure that it will improve the saddle fit and comfort for your horse. So kudos to Justin over at TotalSaddleFit.com for taking the time to really invent a piece of tack that is not only nice looking and well made, but actually has a practical function. And now, practical function. I think we all need to do something practical like ride our horses more. Especially now that spring is just around the corner, 3 weeks away. How about if we have a little Jared Rogerson, and then we'll get back to some listener questions. Sound good?
Sounds terrific.
City smoke in the air. You can't see it from anywhere. There's a million people driving around, going nowhere. Buildings grew up all around me, but I still got a painted pony. Gonna give her a job, cause she's fat and bored. And I'm gonna ride my horse more. Well, I love to drive my truck. The open road feels pretty good, but just because you can doesn't mean that you always should. And I can hardly breathe. Man, this is killing me. I'm gonna ride my horse more. Mother Nature, she's been beat up. I'd say she's been abused. Now even the ocean's black and blue. Gasoline just turns to haze, and my wallet's on empty anyways. Holding the reins is something I can afford, so I'm gonna ride my horse more. Well, I love to drive my truck.
The open road feels pretty good. But just because you can doesn't mean that you always should. And I can hardly breathe. Man, this is killing me. I'm gonna ride my horse more. Everybody's got an answer for the problems of today. Well, you can find your own solution. As for me, I found my way. 'Cause I can hardly breathe. Man, this is killing me. I'm gonna ride my horse more. Let's ride.
Jared Rogerson, one of our faves here on the Horses in the Morning show. You can find Jared Rogerson's music online on your favorite downloading service, such as Spotify, iTunes, etc. You can also Google him, Jared Rogerson. He has his own website. Now, time to go back to auditor questions, because here on Horses in the Morning, second Thursday of every month, Mary hangs out with me and we geek out on horse training. So take it away, Mary. Who are we going to answer? Whose question are we going to answer?
So many questions, so many really good questions. And I know. I'm just going to go in order for now.
Okay.
So we have one from Caitlin. Oh, this is an interesting last name. Drozdowski. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And the question is, I've always understood the term colt as a young uncut male horse, but I've noticed in some situations that it sounds as though it's is used for an untrained horse. Is that true? I've only heard it used in some Western riders. So just curious about it. And as much as I am a stickler for correct usage of terms and grammar and spelling and stuff, I'm super guilty of this. So you are correct. The cult term is really referencing a young stallion and an uncut male horse. But I know in the Western world, we tend to say colt starting as a catch-all for, we're going to take all the two-year-old horses and train them to ride. And that doesn't matter if they're a boy, girl, gelding. And a colt's just kind of a catch-all for that. It can be both. It's just one of those, I wouldn't call it a slang term, but if you're in the Western circles and you say colt starting, it's generally understood that that could be any gender horse.
More of a generic term, maybe would be the right.
Yeah. So, short answer, good question. Let me go on to the next one. I'm going to circle back to that second one. Any advice? This one comes from Marielle Louise. I cannot pronounce the last name. Janqueen. I know that's incorrect. Marielle Louise. So the question is, any advice on training for a 10-month-old Percheron? He's my first colt I'm raising. And I'm assuming this is a young, uncut male horse. I'm pretty sure that's how it's being used in this term. First colt I'm raising, thinking of using him for dressage in the future. I've just been working on leading and stopping when I stop and backing up. He stands well for grooming and farrier. Any tips would be appreciated. Thanks. Well, I think you're off to a great start, and you're working on some very useful and practical things that he's going to need. So leading and stopping, you know, reading your body language, stopping when you stop, backing, perfect. Sounds like you've got him doing really well for the farrier. So you're off to a great start. A couple of things that I like to teach is basic groundwork is, so the stopping when you stop, really excellent work. Another thing I like to teach a horse is, if I need you to back out of my space, I should be able to get that done without having to move my own feet, if that makes sense. So I teach this in times where, something scary might be going on, for like we were talking about, maybe the neighbors are cutting down trees and you know your horse is probably going to spook. And especially if it's a horse that's a pretty big horse, as he will soon be, you want to make sure he doesn't spook on you, step on your toes, or push you over accidentally as he's spooking. So in those situations, I like to be able to wiggle the lead rope and have my horse back well away from me so that if they spook, they can do it. They can do so, you know, out of my space. So that would be something I'd start teaching them now. So I use a long, good weighted lead rope to do this. So like your typical natural horsemanship style marine rope works really well. And I will face the horse directly and I'll give that rope a little wiggle. So just a tiny little wiggle. And then if they don't back up, I increase if you think of the rope as like a wavelength, I make that wavelength of that rope more wavy. So I wiggled that rope a little bit more, and then I just keep increasing that a little bit more until the horse backs up one step, and then I release. So I've done this with draft horses before. Now he's a little guy and it sounds like he's already pretty respectful. So he might be very sensitive to this, and you're able to wiggle the rope just a little bit and he backs up. But in some cases, I've noticed with draft horses, backing isn't something they're really keen on doing, you know, not at least not with a lot of gusto. And you can end up in a vicious cycle with a draft horse of you went from on a pressure scale 0 to 10 really quick, and now you're using the most you can imagine using, and that horse is still staring at you. And with a draft horse, you know, you can really go to town with pressure, and they might just be like, you're not affecting me in any way. You don't want to get to that point where you feel like you're just being extremely aggressive on something and you're not getting a good answer. So on some horses, if I can't get them to back up a step, I will release if they even lean back. We'll, you know, find a starting point. You don't want to extend all your pressure to where you feel like you're having to be way too aggressive and you're still not getting anywhere. So I'll look, if I don't think I could possibly get him to back up, I'll settle for even just lean back a little bit and then release there and get that several times in a row. And that can help you get to that first backup step. Once I get one backup step, I'll see if I can get two and then three and then four and then so on. The end product is I want to be able to just give that rope a slight wiggle and have that horse just back on out of my space and remain there. So that way, and I practice this in a controlled setting. So that way, in a scary setting, I can look at that horse and say, okay, I know you're probably going to want to spook. Why don't you just do it over there and everything will be okay. So you're not standing on top of me. So that's one thing I would add. With young horses, I wouldn't do too much intense, like lunging or tight circles, especially not at a trot or a canter, because they're still growing and everything. But you can do kind of some small, gentle circles where you teach them to go around you, focus on getting a little bend in that circle. You can teach them to go from the circle to yielding their hindquarters and changing directions. That is an exercise that will come in handy for my future groundwork, but it's also going to come in handy for my riding. So a little bit of circle work, you can find more information on that from trainers like Buck Brandeman. He's got really good information on that because that'll take a long time to explain that whole process over the radio. Jen, you have anything to add to this one?
I don't think I do. That's unusual, but I don't have something to gab fully. About. perhaps make it a goal to take him, and I think this is a mistake that many of us make, especially when we have a horse that is going to have, in the long run, a competitive career. We focus so much on the skills he's going to need inside the show pen or inside the arena. We forget about the skills that he needs outside. Maybe if get him into the trailer and literally take him for play days. And that way you don't end up with a Nigel. Yeah. You know, get him used to going into the trailer and just going places for no random reason.
Yeah, good idea. And you can even get this done. Maybe you don't have a trailer. You can't haul out as often as you'd like. But one thing I have started doing with my horses, and this is based off of Steve Hackney's 100-mile challenge, is taking them on walks like a dog. So
we do that a lot.
Start out. Yes. It makes it so it could be a horse that you haven't started yet. He's not old enough to ride, or maybe it's a horse that he rides okay in the arena, but you are not ready. You're not mentally ready to take him on trail rides. You're not sure what's going to happen, or, you know, it's not quite safe enough to maybe ride around your lawn. But you can hand walk him and you start. So he calls it the 100-mile challenge because your goal would be to do like 3 miles in a day, which is a lot. So
that's a long walk, by the way. Yes.
Yeah. If you do that, like for a little over a month, you're getting close to 100 miles. So you don't have to do that. And that's a lot for a young horse. But start just kind of, I've done this with my Mustangs. They get very used to the small enclosed arena I work them in. And then the first time I open the gates and walk them out, it's like, I'm only 2 feet from where we just were. Yeah. So, and I find myself just staying locked in the arena because I'm like, you know what? I don't want to deal with that right now. And so what I've started doing is okay, we're going to go out the gate and walk a couple small circles and then go right back in the gate. And then the next day I make that area bigger. And then pretty soon I progress to where I'm walking all over my property with the horse. And you can work on your leading skills of keeping them beside you, keeping pace with you, stopping when you stop, backing when you back. So even though you're not hauling out, you're giving them the experience of new and novel things. And it's fun for them, not just in the arena, just going round and round and round. They've got plenty of years ahead of them to do that kind of stuff. So for young horses, I think that'd be an excellent
stuff. Excellent. It's going to be the most well-rounded Percheron ever.
Yes.
All right. Who's next?
Okay. Nan's question, any suggestions for teaching myself not to flinch when my horse does? It goes right me, I'm kind of sensitive to my surroundings. I'm in the process of decaffeinating myself. Oh, very good. that'll help. So yes, this is an incredibly common problem or issue, and I deal with this often myself. And it gets worse if you're riding a horse that something has happened before, maybe you've even fallen off of this horse. So then you start looking for things to speak at yourself and you start becoming afraid of signs in the arena because your horse is afraid of signs in the arena. And it just becomes this vicious cycle of you guys feeding off each other's energy. And even though we know we're supposed to relax and, you know, be the leader, when you're in the moment, it is so hard. So I hope I have some advice for this. One thing I would be mindful of, what I see happen with a lot of people, and I see this happen at shows often, is that riders on their horse, and they are looking, as they're riding around, they are looking at all the things they know their horse will spook at. you put all your energy into that yellow sign in the corner that you know he's probably going to spook at, and you're looking right at it and you're getting tense. And big surprise, your horse then spooks at the sign. Now, he might have spooked at the sign in any case, but as you are riding up to it and you're putting all your focus and energy on that sign and you're getting tense, ready for something to happen, your horse goes, oh, that person is feeling really weird right now. And they're looking at that sign. So maybe that sign is something I should be scared of too. And I'm going to go ahead and spook. So you have to kind of fight your urge to be looking for the boogeyman behind every corner. You want to be vigilant. You want to be mindful of things that might spook your horse. But if I'm riding up to that sign, I try to look ahead to where we're going, not at what my horse will spook at. So, and looking where you're going makes a difference. They can feel that. So if my horse is looking at the sign, I look on ahead, say, no, you've got to ride to that corner right there, and we're going to go forward. And if I put my focus on the job and where we're going, and I do it, and I have this air of confidence and being relaxed, you'd be so surprised at how often that will actually pull the horse out of a spook. And the best example, and I've probably talked about this on the show before, I use this story all the time. It was such a fine piece of horsemanship that I witnessed. It helped me kind of get a mental idea of how I want to be on my horse. I was at the Stock Horse of Texas World Show several years ago with a young horse. I rode to the horse called Pow. So he's a three-year-old. He hadn't shown very often. And I'm at this really big, busy, reined cow horse type show. And I was in the pen where all the guys were getting ready for the cow classes. So they're, you know, trotting the horse forward, stopping, roll back, going the other way. And we're all getting our horses warmed up. Well, one cowboy, and he's someone I know, is a really cool guy. He had, at some horse sale like a week before, bought this random hackney pony. Like, it looked like a little roadster pony that hauls a cart. He had bought it at some horse auction. And he brought this to the show, to the cow horse show. Yeah. So all of a sudden, I hear across the asphalt parking lot this trip, 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 trip. And I look over and I see this high-stepping hackney pulling this cart. And I look at that and I go, oh, heck no. And I get off my horse. I'm like, nope, game over. I'm not dealing with this. Because I have been dumped because of a cart before. Like, I have PTSD from it. So I got off of my horse. I had him face me. I had him stay safe distance. And I was like, I'm not going to be a hero and ride through this. Because I knew, like, my horse hasn't seen this. This is going to be very spooky. And as this little hackney pony trotted by this arena, all these like ranch, grizzled old ranch quarter horses that have seen everything except this, they all kind of go scatter, and they're going everywhere in the arena like a pinball machine. And this one cowboy is on this horse, and he's got like a nice big loose rein on his horse already, and he's with cow horse stuff. As this little hackney pony trots by, this horse starts to go, oh my God. And you think he's just going to explode. And what this cowboy does was so interesting. He did not shorten his reins. He did not even bend the horse around like I would have done into a one rein stop to get control. He just went slack in battle. Like, he collapsed his core, kind of slumped his shoulders a little bit, sat real, real deep, and just went completely neutral, deep seated in that saddle, completely relaxed. And the horse started to jump back and forth a little bit, and that guy, he followed the motion, stayed centered in that saddle, but he did not like bring his energy up. There was no energy in him. He just kind of sat deep, like he was not riding. You know, he didn't have any riding energy, if that makes any sense. He just stayed deep and centered in that saddle and completely relaxed. He did not touch the reins. So that horse started to go left, and then he started to go right, and then the horse kind of slowed down and then just stopped. Lick chew, started licking and chewing. All because that guy did not feed into his horse's energy. And I saw that. I was like, oh my gosh, that's like one of the greatest pieces of horsemanship I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Now, that's admirable and it's a goal. And we all can't be that perfect. But it gave me a visual of when my horse goes high, I go low. When my horse's energy goes up, I need to consciously make an effort to keep my energy down. And I think a lot of us don't have faith that that will work. I've seen it firsthand. I've experienced it firsthand. If you keep your energy at a certain level, they will come back to you. Some things that can help you get to that point is deep breaths. If you're on a horse that, like maybe you're starting a colt for the first time, or it's a spooky horse and you know he's probably going to spook, get what I call a faraway look in your eye. Don't put all your energy on the ground. Don't look at the ground. If you look at the ground, you're going to go to the ground. So don't look down. Don't look at the ground. Don't look at the spooky thing your horse is spooking at. Get this kind of focus where you can kind of see everything around you. You can take in the horizon. And what that does is it kind of brings your focus up and out of the super scary thing. And you get a really good sense of your surroundings. And it kind of helps bring you out of all that tension and all that scariness. And yeah. Just don't forget to breathe. Deep breath. Yeah. Just think. Heels down. Sit deep.
I think every rider deals with this to some degree and at some level. And for Nan, she already recognizes it as something that she needs to work on for herself in order to make it work better on her horse. So one of the things that she might try too is she says that she is already sensitive to her surroundings. Do things off the horse where you go, yep, I'm hypersensitive to my surroundings right now. Let me work on it. When she's not on the horse, ride a bike, go for a walk, hang out in the arena while other people are riding, take your horse for a hand walk or do groundwork so that he's not getting that direct feedback from your physical body sitting on his back. And you can work on having that larger picture. Situational awareness, where you're aware of everything that's going on. Therefore, you don't have to spook at it, human or horse, because you're taking it all in a little at a time versus having a narrow laser focus. You're very focused on one thing so that when you do perceive something outside that narrow focus, it's a big surprise, right? That's something you could do. Sally Swift talks a lot about this in her books. I believe it's Sally Swift. Having a soft eye, something that I have to struggle with. I don't have the hypersensitivity in that it makes me flinch problem. I just forget what's out there. I need to keep things. And I get very intense and I get physically too strong when I ride and I don't stay soft. So I get where she's coming from with that one. One of the things that helps me a lot, and this is, again, something that I've only recently become proficient enough at that I don't have to continuously think about it, is always keeping my mind that I am with the horse. I'm not telling the horse where to go. I am with the horse. That whole be one with the horse, so that when he has a moment, jumps to the side, backs up, spooks forward a little bit, whatever that happens in that instant, I'm going along for the ride. So let's say we're walking down the road and someone has very wisely put up a giant wreath made of silver sparkly garland on their front gate.
Oh, lovely.
And it blows in the breeze and it sparkles. And I don't know it's there, but because I've got a soft eye, I have a wider focus. I am aware that it's there. I've taught myself to not stare it down because that's what I want to do. I want to stare at it. Watch it coming. No, don't do that. Just be aware of it. I might put Nigel to work a little bit. Okay, let's practice some shoulder in so that we're a little bit facing away from that. So he has something to think about, and so do I. But I'm also keeping in my mindset that if he has a moment and he jettisons himself off to the side, you know, I'm going to the side with you. We'll fix it later. Because the last thing I want to do is go, don't jump to the side. Don't jump to the side. Don't jump to the side. Because then subconsciously, my entire body is already disconnected from my horse. My horse is off to the side in my brain and visually and internally. He's off to the side and I've been left behind like Wile E. Coyote. Be with him. If he spooks, he spooks. He's done it before. He'll do it again. I'm going along for the ride. If we end up 6 feet over there on the shoulder of the road, that's okay. When we get there, I can put my right leg on him and we can straighten it out again. And doing that all the time, not just when there's a moment that might be spooky. Because if you only do it when there's moments that are potentially spooky, you're going to get, everything's going to get tensed up. Do it all the time. Always be with the horse. No matter where he's going physically, you're with him. You're along for the ride because, hello, how are you going to take charge if you get left behind? That has really helped me a lot.
That's really good advice. And I have to turn into a geek for a second because that little like thought process reminded me of that Star Wars Rogue One movie. Mm-hmm. Donnie Yen's character, who's kind of like a pseudo Jedi, he kept saying, "I'm one with the Force. The Force is with me." You can make that mantra work for your horse.
See,
I'm one with the horse. And just repeat that over and over.
That's perfect.
And well, and being aware of your surroundings. I've learned, you know, like with meditation and stuff. At first, we try to kind of like shut down and block out all the distractions,
yes,
and intrusive thoughts, and you just try to turn everything off and block it out. But it's impossible. It gets worse. And so, if you're meditating, and a plane flies overhead, or just a random thought pops in your head, the practice is, you know, observe it, acknowledge it, and then just let it float away like a little bubble. And so when you're in the stressful situation with your horse and you hear that, oh, they fired up the tractor over there, and you're getting ready to drag the arena, instead of going, oh my gosh, and jumping yourself, just acknowledge that that's going on and, you know, just let it fade into the background. And this is something, it's very hard, but the more you kind of practice that of, you know, you're aware of your surroundings, but you're not letting it kind of interrupt your thought process or, you know, make you be reactive and tense. So hopefully that helps. A lot of good stuff there.
Yeah, that's a good one, because I could geek out on that one for another half an hour, just that one question, that whole process of being one with the Force. Next question.
Okay. So this one is from Krista Schrader Youngblood. Maybe you've talked about this before. Her question starts, can you talk about how you integrate both positive reinforcement training along with standard pressure release training? Why/when you choose one over the other in general situations, and how to use the two methods together to improve training? Do you use both together on one concept when you're teaching the horse? She goes on to talk about how her Mustang's quickly adapting the positive reinforcement training. She needs him to also understand pressure release because she's not the only person who's ever going to handle the horse. Too much pressure can cause him to shut down both on the ground and under saddle. She's been working to reverse his PTSD on pressure release from previous life experience. She'd like to integrate the two methods to help him still be able to take lessons and clinics with trainers who use pressure and release. That is a terrific question. So when I first started the clicker training process or positive reinforcement training, this turned my mind into knots, and it still does. So I had dabbled in the idea of adapting nearly 100% of my training program using positive reinforcement protocols, which for the most part involve rewarding your horse for the things you like and ignoring everything else. And if you do that, and this does work, if you do that, pretty soon you'll only be left with the things that you've rewarded. So that would be the good behaviors, hopefully, and the other things will fall to the wayside. Working with 1,000-pound horses is not always possible. One of my favorite clicker mentors, Alexandra Curlin, says sometimes life just happens, which means sometimes you clicking and treating your horse and everything's great and it's soft and it's very low energy and your horse spooks and tries to run into you. Well, you shouldn't just sacrifice your body in the name of only doing positive reinforcement. I may have to get big and scary and throw my hands up and say, hey, don't run into me. Or my horse, starts to swing his head at me and, you know, I might need to throw my hand up and use some positive punishment or use something that tells my horse, don't do that. You're going to feel uncomfortable if you do. Sometimes life happens with 1,000-pound animal and you need to stay. We try when we're doing positive reinforcement training to set up situations using things like protective contact, like putting a barrier between you and the horse where we won't have to do that. But again, sometimes life happens. These are big animals. Sometimes they spook and we have to do what we have to do to stay safe. So even in a purely, quote unquote, purely positive program, sometimes that horse is going to deal with pressure, no matter how perfect you try to make it. The other thing about purely positive, when someone says, oh, I'm pure positive reinforcement, in my mind, that is a mistruth. And maybe that person doesn't quite fully comprehend what the terms positive and negative reinforcement mean. The only one in the training situation who can say what is aversive and what is non-aversive, meaning what makes them feel pressure and stress and what does not make them feel pressure and stress, is the horse. So I could be doing something that I feel is completely benign, like petting the horse on the face and think, oh, he'll find this rewarding. But some horses don't. They find it aversive, especially a Mustang in the very beginning of training. I have to train them to accept touch. Eventually, they can find it comforting. But in the beginning, me touching them might be the thing that makes them most want to jump out of the round pen. So with any horse at any given time in training, only that horse truly can tell you what is positive reinforcement to them. So I think no matter how pure you try to be, that horse is going to find something you're doing that's aversive, that makes them feel uncomfortable, that makes them feel pressure. So that horse will deal with pressure no matter how good you try to be. So I want to get that out there. The other thing, and this is where I sort of branch off from the sort of mainstream group of positive reinforcement trainers, is like Krista, most of my horses will be handled by someone else. They may go on to new homes. I may only have them in training for a limited amount of time, so not enough time to maybe use as much positive reinforcement training I'd like to get them to a good spot. And they might not be going back home to someone who's going to use those protocols. So in those cases, especially, I want my horse to understand pressure because they're going to run into it. They need to know how to deal with it. But even if it's my horse and I have carefully created an environment where they'll only feel good things, something is likely to happen in that horse's life where he will deal with an extreme amount of pressure. Maybe at 5 a.m, he's colicking horribly and I have to get him on a trailer when he's feeling the worst he's ever felt in his life and run him down the road. And he's got to go into a strange building and be handled by strange people and poked and prodded and palpated. And he's going to have to get through that. And if he's never learned to deal with pressure of, you know, I've got to get you on this trailer, I've got to get you into these chutes at the vet, he might be way too reactive to be able to safely be handled in that situation. So something's always going to happen that sort of brings us out of that, like that kind of zen place of we're only doing positive. They're going to experience pressure. So like my very first Mustang that I trained for the Extreme Mustang Makeover, I had made the commitment to see if I could do as much positive reinforcement training as I possibly could using the knowledge I had of it at the time. So I had done this very successfully. I'd gotten my hands on him, first touch. I got a halter on him. He's leading around really good. Everything's going great. I had done it all using things like target training. And he was really wonderful. But given the limited amount of time I had to train this horse, I knew that very soon I was going to have to open that arena gate and walk him into the open. And at this point, the horse has never really felt anything incredibly uncomfortable. We kept it pretty low energy, gone pretty well. And he had never hit that halter full force. Like he'd never spooked and ran into that halter and learned how to deal with that. Because everything had just been really low energy. So I knew when I opened this arena gate and we go out into the great blue, you know, great unknown with this horse, something was probably going to cause him to spook and he probably was going to run into the full pressure of that halter. And I knew that I had to teach him what to do if this happened, because the worst case scenario he spooks, he feels that halter tighten on his nose because I'm trying to hang on to him. And it makes him feel really uncomfortable. And I knew if I didn't teach him, his first reaction was going to be panic. And he was going to just bolt and pull that rope out of my hand. And now we're in a bit of a pickle. He's loose on a large property with a lead rope dragging behind him. I wanted to prevent that. So I needed to create a situation where he was going to feel pressure on that halter and it was going to make him feel uncomfortable and it was going to make him want to run harder. But I had to teach him, this is what you do when you feel that. So I call these fire drills. So at this point, I'd moved very slowly and carefully with this horse and he was still very sensitive. So I knew if I moved really quickly, he was going to want to spook. So I was in the arena with him. And I just kind of, you know, had a spasm and just kind of moved real quick and abruptly. And he looked at me and he was like, ah, and he spooked. And I just kind of stood in the middle of the arena like a fence post. And I didn't like jerk on the halter. I didn't really pull on the halter. I just let him run into the pressure of me holding onto the lead rope. And so at first he ran into the halter and I just stood my ground and I was kind of angled at a point where he would have to yield his hindquarters and face me. So he hit the halter, yielded his hindquarters around, and then faced me. And as soon as he did that, I clicked, treat, pet, loved on him, gave him a huge, huge reward. And I did that a couple of times until pretty soon he would not hit the full force of that halter. He wouldn't even take the slack out of that lead rope. And then I knew at least to have a baseline. Okay, if this happens in the real world, when we walk out there, he knows what to do. The answer is yield and face. Sorry, I'm tapped into something here real quick. So that is an example of what I do when I deal with this, when I'm working with integrating methods. And when you're using one, so that's one way that I will sort of introduce this idea of pressure when I'm clicker training. But in general, when you're clicker training, there's a way you can do this where you do what's called piggybacking. So let's say you're a really big John Lyons fan or you're a huge Monty Roberts fan and this has worked for you and everything's gone really well and you'd like to integrate positive reinforcement training into that, but you don't want to throw away everything you've learned from John Lyons, Monty Roberts, or whoever your big favorite trainer is. You can still use those methods that they use and then add the concept of clicker. So you're using still the release of pressure to let the horse know, hey, that was a good job. But then you're also using positive reinforcement. So you can release pressure, click, and give them a treat. So you're using both of those methods in conjunction with each other. Some people, I will say, don't agree with this. They're a little bit more purist and don't want to introduce any kind of pressure if they can help it. And that's your own journey. You've got to figure out for yourself. But I truly believe it is okay to take your favorite program that is more of a negative reinforcement based program, and you can just simply piggyback the clicker on top of that and still be successful. So hopefully that helps. I could talk about that for 4 more hours, but hopefully that gives you some ideas.
I love the piggyback idea. I think
yes,
your next video needs to be an example of piggybacking. Take one of your horses that's already got use Guthrie or something who understands how it works and video the process of piggybacking like that, because I find that fascinating. I like it.
Yeah, it's a good way to get your feet wet, especially if you don't know where to go with the clicker. Just do what you do and then add the click as your reward for
it. I think that's great. Well, I think that's going to be a good spot to wrap up for today. As usual, many, many more questions, not enough time to answer them all. We're just going to have to start having Mary on twice a month.
Okay.
And in closing, you can find links to today's guests at horsesinthemorning.com. You'll find links to topics, etc. And you can follow us on Facebook. Just type in Horses in the Morning. Our handle on Twitter is Horse Radio. Make sure you have downloaded the app, the Horse Radio Network app for your iPhone or your Android. Go to your app store and search Horse Radio Network. Download it today. It's free. It's easy to use. For your less tech-savvy friends, download it for them and show them how to use it. They will appreciate it and thank you later. And thank you very much to our title sponsor today, Horseware, the folks who distribute a product called Ice Vibe. It is a science-based process of massage and cold therapy to help your horse get ready to work and recover after work. I suggest you check it out at horsewear.com. And also, thank you very much to Total Saddle Fit, the folks who make the shoulder relief, cinch, and girth. So that's it for today, Mary. We'll see you next month on the second Thursday.
All right. See you then.